Chapter 8, The Nature Theater of Oklahoma. At a street corner, Carl saw a placard with the following announcement. The Oklahoma Theater will engage members for its company today at Clayton Racecourse from 6 o'clock in the morning until midnight. The Great Theater of Oklahoma calls you. Today only, and never again. If you miss your chance now, you miss it forever. If you think of your future, you are one of us. Everyone is welcome. If you want to be an artist, join our company. Our theater can find employment for everyone, a place for everyone. If you decide on an engagement, we congratulate you here and now. But hurry, so that you can get in before midnight. At 12 o'clock, the doors will be shut and never opened again. Down with all those who do not believe in us. Up and to Clayton. A great many people were certainly standing before the placard, but it did not seem to find much approval. There were so many placards, nobody believed in them any longer, and this placard was even more improbable than usual. Above all, it failed in an essential particular. It did not mention payment. If the payment were worth mentioning at all, the placard would certainly have mentioned it. That most attractive of all arguments would not have been forgotten. No one wanted to be an artist, but every man wanted to be paid for his labors. Yet for Carl there is one great attraction in the placard. Everyone is welcome. It said. Everyone. That meant Carl, too. All that he had done till now was ignored. It was not going to be made a reproach of him. He was entitled to apply for a job of which he need not be ashamed, which, on the contrary, was a matter of public advertisement. And just as public was the promise that he, too, would find acceptance. He asked for nothing better. He wanted to find some way of at least beginning a decent life, and perhaps this was his chance. Even if all the extravagant statements in the placard were a lie, even if the Great Theater of Oklahoma were an insignificant traveling circus it wanted to engage people, and that was enough. Carl did not read the whole placard over again, but once more singled out the sentence, "Everyone is welcome." At first he thought of going to Clayton on foot, yet that would mean 3 hours of hard walking, and in all possibility, he might arrive just in time to hear that every available vacancy has been filled. The placard certainly suggested that there were no limits to the number of people who could be engaged, but all advertisements of that kind were worded like that. Carl saw that he must either give it up or else go by train. He counted over his money, which would last him for 8 days yet if he did not take this railway journey. He slid the little coins backwards and forwards on the palm of his hand. A gentleman who had been watching him clapped him on the shoulder and said, "All good luck for your journey to Clayton." Carl nodded silently and reckoned up his money again. But he soon came to a decision, counted out the money he needed for the fare, and rushed to the underground station. When he got out to Clayton, he heard at once the noise of many trumpets. It was a confused blaring. The trumpets were not in harmony, but were blown regardless of each other. Still, that did not worry Carl. He took it rather as a confirmation of the fact that the Theater of Oklahoma was a great undertaking. But when he emerged from the station and surveyed the layout before him, he realized that it was all on a much larger scale than he could have possibly conceived, and he did not understand how any organization could make such extensive preparations merely for the purpose of taking on employees. Before the entrance to the race course, a long low platform had been set up, on which hundreds of women dressed as angels in white robes with great wings on their shoulders were blowing on long trumpets that glittered like gold. They were not actually standing on the platform, but were mounted on separate pedestals, which could not, however, be seen, since they were completely hidden by the long flowing draperies of the robes. Now, as the pedestals were very high, some of them quite 6 feet high, these women looked gigantic, except that the smallness of their heads spoiled a little of the impression of the size, and their loose hair looked too short and almost absurd hanging between the great wings and framing their faces. To avoid monotony, the pedestals were of all sizes. There were women quite low down, not much over life-size, but beside them others soared to such a height that one felt the slightest gust of wind could capsize them, and all these women were blowing their trumpets. There were not many listeners. Dwarfed by comparison with these great figures, some 10 boys were walking about before the platform and looking up at the women. They called each other's attention to this one or that, but seemed to have no idea of entering and offering their services. Only one older man was to be seen. He stood a little to one side. He had brought his wife with him, and a child in a perambulator. The wife was holding the perambulator with one hand, and with the other supporting herself on her husband's shoulder. They were clearly admiring the spectacle, but one could see all the same that they were disappointed. They too had apparently expected to find some sign of work, and this blowing of trumpets confused them. Carl was in the same position. He walked over to where the man was standing, listening for a little to the trumpets, and then said, "Isn't this the place where they are engaging people for the theater of Oklahoma?"
"I thought so too," said the man. "But we've been waiting here for an hour and heard nothing but these trumpets. There's not a placard to be seen, no announcers, nobody anywhere to tell you what to do."
Carl said, "Perhaps they're waiting until more people arrive. There are really very few here."
"Possibly," said the man,
and they were silent again. Besides, it was difficult to hear anything through the din of the trumpets. But then the woman whispered to her husband. He nodded, and he called at once to Carl.
"Couldn't you go into the race course and ask where the workers are being taken on?"
"Yes," said Carl.
"But I would have to cross the platform among all the angels."
"Is that so very difficult?" asked the woman.
She seemed to think it an easy path for Carl, but she was unwilling to let her husband go.
"All right," said Carl. "I'll go."
"That's very good of you," said the woman,
and both she and her husband took Carl's hand and pressed it. The boys all came rushing up to get a near view of Carl climbing the platform. It was as if the woman redoubled their efforts on the trumpets as a greeting to the first applicant. Those whose pedestals Carl's had to pass actually took their trumpets from their mouths and leaned over to follow him with their eyes. On the other side of the platform, Carl discovered a man walking restlessly up and down, obviously only waiting for people so as to give them all the information they might desire. Carl was just about to accost him when he heard someone calling his name above him.
"Carl!"
cried an angel. Carl looked up and in delighted surprise began to laugh. It was Fanny.
"Fanny?"
he exclaimed, waving his hand.
"Come up here!" cried Fanny. "You're surely not going to pass me like that!"
And she parted her draperies so that the pedestal and a little ladder leaning up to it became visible.
"Is one allowed to go up?" asked Carl.
"Who can forbid us to shake hands?" cried Fanny,
and she looked round indignantly, in case anyone might be coming to intervene. But Carl was already running up the ladder.
"Not so fast!" cried Fanny. "The pedestal and both of us will come to grief."
But nothing happened. Carl reached the top in safety.
"Just look," said Fanny, after they had greeted each other. "Just look what a job I've got."
"It's a fine job,"
said Carl, looking round him. All the women near had noticed him and begun to giggle.
"You're almost the highest of them all,"
said Carl, and he stretched out his hand to measure the height of the others.
"I saw you at once," said Fanny, "as soon as you came to the station, but I'm in the last row here. Unfortunately, nobody can see me, and I couldn't shout either. I blew as loudly as I could, but you didn't recognize me."
"You all play very badly," said Carl.
"Let me have a turn."
"Why, certainly," said Fanny, handing him the trumpet. "But don't spoil the show, or else I'll get the sack."
Carl began to blow into the trumpet. He had imagined it was a roughly fashioned instrument intended merely to make a noise, but now he discovered that it was an instrument capable of almost any refinement of expression. If all the instruments were of the same quality, they were being very ill-used. Paying no attention to the blaring of the others, he played with all the power of his lungs, an air which he had once heard in some tavern or other. He felt happy at having found an old friend, and at being allowed to play a trumpet as a special privilege, and at the thought that he might likely get a good post very soon. Many of the women stopped playing to listen. When he suddenly broke off, scarcely half the trumpets were in action, and it took a little while for the general din to work up to full power again.
"But you are an artist," said Fanny when Carl handed her the trumpet again. "Ask to be taken on as a trumpeteer."
"Are men taken on for it too?" said Carl.
"Oh yes," said Fanny. "We play for 2 hours, then we're relieved by men who are dressed as devils. Half of them blow, the other half beat on drums. It's very fine, but the whole outfit is just as lavish. Don't you think our robes are beautiful? And the wings?" She looked down at herself.
"Do you think," asked Carl, "that I'll get a job here too?"
"Most certainly," said Fanny. "Why, it's the greatest theater in the world. What a piece of luck that we're to be together again. All the same, it depends on what job you get, for it would be quite possible for us not to see each other at all, even though we were both engaged here."
"Is the place really so big as that?" asked Carl.
"It's the biggest theater in the world," Fanny said again. "I haven't seen it myself, I admit, but some of the other girls here who have been in Oklahoma already say that there are almost no limits to it."
But there aren't many people here, said Carl, pointing down at the boys and the little family.
That's true, said Fanny. But consider that we pick up people in all the towns, that our recruiting outfit here is always on the road, and that there are ever so many of these outfits.
Why, has the theater not opened yet? Asked Carl.
Oh, yes, said Fanny. It's an old theater, but it's always being enlarged.
I'm surprised, said Carl, that more people don't flock to join it.
Yes, said Fanny. It's extraordinary.
Perhaps, said Carl, this display of angels and devils frightens people off more than it attracts them.
What made you think of that? Said Fanny. But you may be right. Tell that to our leader. Perhaps it might be helpful.
Where is he? Asked Carl.
On the race course, said Fanny. On the umpire's platform.
That surprises me, too, said Carl. Why a race course for engaging people?
Oh, said Fanny. We always make great preparations in case there should be a great crowd. There's lots of space on a race course, and in all the stands where the bets are laid on ordinary days, offices are set up to sign on recruits. There must be 200 different offices there.
But, cried Carl, has the theater of Oklahoma have such a huge income that it can maintain recruiting establishments to that extent?
What does that matter to us? Said Fanny. But you'd better go now, Carl, so that you don't miss anything. I must begin to blow my trumpet again. Do your best to get a job in this outfit, and come and tell me at once. Remember that I'll be waiting very impatiently for the news.
She pressed his hand, warned him to be cautious in climbing down, set the trumpet to her lips again, but did not blow until she saw Carl safely on the ground. Carl arranged the robe over the ladder again, as it had been before. Fanny nodded her head thanks, and Carl, still considering from various angles what he had just heard, approached the man, who had already seen him up on Fanny's pedestal and had come close to it to wait for him.
"You want to join us?" asked the man. "I am the staff manager of this company, and I bid you welcome."
He had a slight permanent stoop as if out of politeness, fidgeted with his feet, though without moving from the spot, and played with his watch chain.
"Thank you," said Carl. "I've read the placard your company put out, and I have come here as I was requested."
"Quite right," said the man appreciatively. "Unluckily, there aren't many who do the same."
It occurred to Carl that he could now tell the man that perhaps the recruiting company failed because of the very splendor of its attractions. But he did not say so, for this man was not the leader of the company, and besides, it would not be much of a recommendation for him if he began making suggestions for the improvement of the outfit before even being taken on. So he merely said,
"There is another man waiting out there who wants to report here too, and simply sent me on ahead. May I fetch him now?"
"Of course," said the man. "The more, the better."
"He has a wife with him, too, and a small child in a perambulator. Are they to come, too?"
"Of course," said the man, and he seemed to smile at Carl's doubts. "We can use all of them."
"I'll be back in a minute," said Carl,
and he ran back to the edge of the platform. He waved to the married couple and shouted that everybody could come. He helped the man to lift the perambulator onto the platform, and then they proceeded together. The boys, seeing this, consulted with each other, and then, their hands in their pockets, hesitating to the last instant, slowly climbed onto the platform and followed Carl and the family. Just then, some fresh passengers emerged from the underground station and raised their arms in astonishment when they saw the platform and the angels. However, it seemed that the competition for jobs would now become more lively. Carl felt very glad that he was such an early arrival, perhaps the first of them all. The married couple were apprehensive and asked various questions as to whether great demands would be made on them. Carl told them that he knew nothing definite yet, but he had received the impression that everyone without exception would be engaged. He thought they could feel easy in their minds. The staff manager advanced towards them, very satisfied that so many were coming. He rubbed his hands, greeted everyone with a little bow, and arranged them all in a row. Carl was the first, then came the husband and wife, and after that the others. When they were all ranged up, the boys kept jostling each other at first, and it took some time to get them in order. The staff manager said, while the trumpets fell silent,
"I greet you in the name of the Theater of Oklahoma. You have come early," but it was already midday. "There is no great rush yet, so that the formalities necessary for engaging you will soon be settled. Of course, you all have your identification papers."
The boys at once pulled papers out of their pockets and flourished them at the staff manager. The husband nudged his wife,
who pulled out a whole bundle of papers from under the blankets of the perambulator, but Carl had none. Would that prevent him from being taken on? He knew well enough from experience that with a little resolution it should be easy to get round such regulations. Very likely he would succeed. The staff manager glanced along the row, assured himself that everyone had papers, and since Carl also had stood with his hand raised, though it was empty, he assumed that in his case, too, everything was in order. "Very good," said the staff manager with a reassuring wave of the hand to the boys, who wanted to have their papers examined at once. "The papers will now be scrutinized in the employment bureaus. As you will have seen already from our placard, we can find employment for everyone. But we must know, of course, what occupations you have followed until now, so that we can put you in the right places to make use of your knowledge." "But it's a theater," thought Carl dubiously, and he listened very intently. "We have accordingly," went on the staff manager, "set up employment bureaus in the bookmakers' booths, an office for each trade or profession. So each of you will now tell me his occupation. A family is generally registered at the husband's employment bureau. I shall then take you to the offices, where first your papers and then your qualifications will be checked by experts. It will only be a quite short examination. There's nothing to be afraid of. You will then be signed on at once and receive your further instructions. So let us begin. This first office is for engineers, as the inscription tells you. Is there perhaps an engineer here?" Carl stepped forward. He thought that his lack of papers made it imperative for him to rush through the formalities with all possible speed. He had also a slight justification in putting himself forward, for he had once wanted to be an engineer. But when the boys saw Carl reporting himself, they grew envious and put up their hands too, all of them. The staff manager rose to his full height and said to the boys, "Are you engineers?" Their hands slowly wavered and sank, but Carl stuck to his first decision. The staff manager certainly looked at him with incredulity, for Carl seemed too wretchedly clad and also too young to be an engineer. But he said nothing further, perhaps out of gratitude because Carl, at least in his opinion, had brought the applicants in. He simply pointed courteously towards the office and Carl went across to it, while the staff manager turned to the others. In the Bureau for Engineers, two gentlemen were sitting at either side of a rectangular counter comparing two big lists which lay before them. One of them read, while the other made a mark against names in his list. When Carl appeared and greeted them, they laid aside the list at once and brought out two great books which they flung open. One of them, who was obviously only a clerk, said, "Please give me your identity papers."
"I'm sorry to say that I haven't got them with me," said Carl.
"He hasn't got them with him," said the clerk to the other gentleman,
at once writing down the answer in his book.
"Are you an engineer?"
thereupon asked the other man, who seemed to be in charge of the bureau.
"I'm not an engineer yet," said Carl quickly, "but..."
"Enough," said the gentleman still more quickly. "In that case, you don't belong to us. Be so good as to note the inscription."
Carl clenched his teeth, and the gentleman must have observed that, for he said, "There's no need to worry. We can employ everyone." And then he made a sign to one of the attendants who were lounging about idly between the barriers.
"Lead this gentleman to the Bureau for Technicians."
The attendant interpreted the command literally and took Carl by the hand. They passed a number of booths on either side. In one, Carl saw one of the boys, who had already been signed on, and was gratefully shaking hands with the gentleman in charge. In the bureau to which Carl was now taken, the procedure was similar to that in the first office, as he had seen before, except that they now dispatched him to the Bureau for Intermediate Pupils, when they had heard that he attended an intermediate school. But when Carl confessed there that it was a European school he had attended, the officials refused to accept him and had him conducted to the Bureau for European Intermediate Pupils. It was a booth on the outer verge of the course, not only smaller but also humbler than all the others. The attendant who conducted him there was furious at the long pilgrimage and then repeated rebuffs, for which in his opinion Carl alone bore the blame. He did not wait for the questioning to begin but went away at once. So this bureau was probably Carl's last chance. When Carl caught sight of the head of the bureau, he was almost startled at his close resemblance to a teacher who was presumably still teaching in the school at home. The resemblance, however, as immediately appeared, was confined to certain details. But the spectacles resting on the man's broad nose, the fair beard as carefully tended as a prize exhibit, the slightly rounded back, and the unexpectedly loud, abrupt voice held Carl in amazement for some time. Fortunately, he had not to attend very carefully, for the procedure here was much simpler than in the other offices. A note was certainly taken of the fact that his papers were lacking,
and the head of the bureau called it an incomprehensible piece of negligence. But the clerk, who seemed to have the upper hand, quickly glossed it over, and after a few brief questions by his superior, while that gentleman was just preparing to put some more important ones, he declared that Carl had been engaged. The head of the bureau turned with open mouth upon his clerk, but the clerk made a definite gesture with his hand, said, "Engaged," and at once entered the decision in his book. Obviously, the clerk considered a European intermediate pupil to be something so ignominious so that anyone who admitted to being one was not worth disbelieving. Carl, for his part, had no objection to this, so he went up to the clerk intending to thank him, but there was another little delay while they asked him what his name was. He did not reply at once. He felt shy of mentioning his own name and letting it be written down. As soon as he had a place here, no matter how small, and filled it satisfactorily, they could have his name, but not now. He had concealed it too long to give it away now. So as no other name occurred to him at the moment, he gave the nickname he had in his last post, Negro.
Negro?
Said the chief, turning his head and making a grimace, as if Carl had now touched the high water mark of incredibility. Even the clerk looked critically at Carl for a while, but then he said, Negro, and wrote the name down.
But certainly you haven't written down Negro, the chief shouted at him. Yes, Negro, said the clerk calmly, and waved his hand,
as if his superior should now continue the proceedings. And the head of the bureau, controlling himself, stood up and said,
You are engaged, then, for the—
But he could not get any further. He could not go against his own conscience, so he sat down and said,
He isn't called Negro.
The clerk raised his eyebrows, got up himself, and said, Then it is my duty to inform you that you have been engaged for the theater in Oklahoma, and that you will now be introduced to our leader. Another attendant was summoned, who conducted Carl to the umpire's platform. At the foot of the steps, Carl caught sight of the perambulator, and at that moment the father and the mother descended, the mother with the baby on her arm.
"Have you been taken on?" asked the man. He was much more lively than before, and his wife smiled at Carl across her shoulder.
When Carl answered that he had just been taken on and was going to be introduced, the man said,
"Then I congratulate you. We have been taken on, too. It seems to be a good thing, though you can't get used to everything all at once, but it's like that everywhere."
They said goodbye to each other again, and Carl climbed up to the platform. He took his time, for the small space above seemed to be crammed with people, and he did not want to be importunate. He'd even paused for a while and gazed at the great race course, which extended on every side to distant woods. He was filled with longing to see a racehorse. He had found no opportunity to do so since he had come to America. In Europe, he had once been taken to a race meeting as a small child, but all that he could remember was that he had been dragged by his mother through throngs of people who were unwilling to make room and let him pass. So that actually he had never seen a race yet. Behind him, a mechanism of some kind began to whir. He turned round and saw on the board where the names of the winners appeared, the following inscription being hoisted. The Merchant Kala with wife and child. So the names of those who were engaged was communicated to all the offices from here. At that moment, several gentlemen with pencils and notebooks in their hands ran down the stairs, busily talking to each other. Carl squeezed against the railing to let them pass, and then went up, as there was now room for him above. In one corner of the platform with its wooden railing, the whole looked like a flat roof of a small tower, a gentleman was sitting with his arms stretched along the railing and a broad white silk sash hanging diagonally across his chest with the inscription, Leader of the 10th Recruiting Squad of the Theater of Oklahoma. On the table stood a telephone, doubtless installed for use during the races, but now obviously employed in giving the leader all necessary information regarding the various applicants before they were introduced, for he did not begin by putting questions to Carl, but said to a gentleman sitting beside him with crossed legs, his chins in his hands, Negro, a European intermediate pupil. And as if with that he had nothing more to say to Carl, who was bowing low before him, he glanced down the stairs to see whether anyone else was coming. As no one came, he lent an ear to the conversation which the other gentleman was having with Carl, but for the most part kept looking at the race course and tapping on the railing with his fingers. These delicate yet powerful, long, nimble fingers attracted Carl's attention from time to time, although he should really have been giving his whole mind to the other gentleman.
"You've been out of work?"
this gentleman began by asking. The question, like almost all the other questions he asked, was very simple and direct,
nor did he check Carl's replies by cross-examining him at all. Yet the way in which he rounded his eyes while he uttered his questions, the way in which he leaned forward to contemplate their effect, the way in which he let his head sink to his chest while he listened to the replies, in some cases repeating them aloud, invested his inquiries with an air of special significance, which one might not understand, but which it made one uneasy to suspect. Many times Carl felt impelled to take back the answer he had given and substitute another which might find more approval, but he always managed to refrain, for he knew what a bad impression such shilly-shallying was bound to make, and how little he really understood for the most part the effect of his answers. Besides, his engagement seemed to be already decided upon, and the consciousness of that gave him support. To the question whether he had been out of work, he replied with a simple yes. "Where were you engaged last?" the gentleman asked next. Carl was just about to answer when the gentleman raised his first finger and repeated again, "Last." As Carl had understood the question perfectly well, he involuntarily shook his head to reject the confusing additional remark and answered, "In an office." This was the truth, but if the gentleman should demand more definite information regarding the kind of office, he would have to tell lies. However, the necessity did not arise, for the gentleman asked a question which it was quite easy to answer with perfect truth. "Were you satisfied there?" "No," exclaimed Carl, almost before the question was finished. Out of the corner of his eye, he could see the leader was smiling faintly. He regretted the impetuosity of his exclamation, but it was too tempting to launch that no. For during all his last term of service, his greatest wish had been that some outside employer of labor might come in and ask him that very question. Still, his negative might put him at another disadvantage if the gentleman were to follow it up by asking why he had not been satisfied. But he asked instead, "For what kind of post do you feel you are best suited?" This question might contain a real trap, for why was it put at all since he had already been engaged as an actor? But although he saw the difficulty, he could not bring himself to say that he felt particularly suited for the acting profession, so he evaded the question and said, at the risk of appearing obstructive, "I read the placard in the town, and it said that you could employ anyone. I came here." "We know that," said the gentleman, showing by his ensuing silence that he insisted on an answer to the question. "I have been engaged as an actor," said Carl hesitantly, to let the gentleman see that he found himself in a dilemma. "Quite so," said the gentleman, and fell silent again. "No," said Carl, and all his hopes of being settled in a job began to totter. "I don't know whether I'm capable of being an actor, but I shall do my best and try to carry out all my instructions." The gentleman turned to the leader. Both of them nodded. Carl seemed to have given the right answer, so he took courage again and, standing erect, waited for the next question. It ran, "What did you want to study originally?" To define the question more exactly, the gentleman seemed to lay great weight on exact definition. He added, "In Europe, I mean," at the same time removing his hand from his chin and waving it slightly as if to indicate both how remote Europe was and how unimportant were any plans that might have been made there. Carl said, "I wanted to be an engineer." This answer almost stuck in his throat. It was absurd of him, knowing as he did the kind of career he had in America, to bring up the old daydream of having wanted to be an engineer. Would he have ever become an engineer even in Europe? But he simply did not know what other answer to make, and so gave this one. Yet the gentleman took it seriously, as he took everything seriously. "Well, you can't turn into an engineer all at once," he said, "but perhaps it would suit you for the time being to be attached to some minor technical work." "Certainly," said Carl. He was perfectly satisfied. True, if he accepted the offer, he would be transferred from the acting profession to the lower status of technical laborer, but he really believed that he could be able to do more justice to himself at technical work. Besides, he kept on telling himself, it was not so much a matter of the kind of work as establishing oneself permanently somewhere. "Are you strong enough for heavy work?" asked the gentleman. "Oh, yes," said Carl. At that, the gentleman asked Carl to come nearer and felt his arm. "He's a strong lad," he said then, pulling Carl by the arm towards the leader. The leader nodded smilingly, reached Carl his hand without changing his lazy posture, and said, "Then that's all settled. In Oklahoma, we'll look into it again. See that you do honor to our recruiting squad." Carl made his bow and also turned to say goodbye to the other gentleman, but he, as if his functions were now discharged, was walking up and down the platform, gazing at the sky.
As Carl went down the steps, the announcement board beside them was showing the inscription, Negro, Technical Worker. As everything here was taking an orderly course, Carl felt that after all he would not have minded seeing his real name on the board. The organization was indeed scrupulously precise, for at the foots of the steps, Carl found a waiting attendant who fastened a band around his arm. When Carl lifted his arm to see what was written on the band, there, right enough, were the words, Technical Worker. But wherever he was to be taken now, he decided that he must first report to Fanny how well everything had gone. To his great sorrow, he learned from the attendant that both the angels and the devils had already left for the next town on the recruiting squad's itinerary, to act as advanced agents for the arrival of the troop next day.
What a pity, said Carl.
It was the first disappointment that he had in this new undertaking.
I had a friend amongst the angels.
You'll see her again in Oklahoma, said the attendant. But now come along, you're the last.
He led Carl along the inner side of the platform on which the angels had been posted, but there was nothing left but the empty pedestals. Yet Carl's assumption that if the trumpeting were stopped, more people would be encouraged to apply was proved wrong, for there were now no grown-up people at all before the platform, only a few children fighting over a long, white feather which had apparently fallen out of an angel's wing. A boy was holding it up in the air, while the other children were trying to push down his head with one hand and reach for the feather with the other. Carl pointed out the children, but the attendant said without looking,
Come on, hurry up. It's taken a long time for you to get engaged. I suppose they weren't sure of you.
I don't know, said Carl in astonishment, but he did not believe it. Always, even in the most unambiguous circumstances, someone could be found to take pleasure in suggesting troubles to his fellow men. But at the friendly aspect of the grandstand, which they were now approaching, Carl soon forgot the attendant's remark. For on the stand there was a long, wide bench covered with a white cloth. All the applicants who had been taken on sat on the bench below it with their backs to the race course, and were being fed. They were all happy and excited, just as Carl, coming last, quietly took his seat. Several of them were rising with upraised glasses, and one of them toasted the leader of the 10th recruiting squad, whom he called the father of all the unemployed. Someone then remarked that the leader could be seen from here, and actually the umpire's platform with the two gentlemen on it was visible at no very great distance. Now they were all raising their glasses in that direction. Carl, too, seized the glass standing in front of him, but loudly as they shouted and hard as they tried to draw attention to themselves, there was no sign on the umpire's platform that the ovation had been observed, or at least that there was any wish to observe it. The leader lounged in his corner as before. The other gentleman stood beside him, resting his chin on his hand. Somewhat disappointed, everybody sat down again. Here and there, one would turn round towards the umpire's platform again, but soon they were all well occupied with the abundant food. Huge birds, such as Carl had never seen before, were carried round with many forks sticking into the crispy roasted meat. The glasses were filled with wine by the attendants. You hardly noticed it. You were busy with your plate, and a stream of red wine simply fell into your glass, and those who did not want to take part in the general conversation could look at views of the Theater of Oklahoma, which lay in a pile at one end of the table and were supposed to pass from hand to hand. But few of the people troubled much about the views, and so it happened that only one of them reached Carl, who was the last in the row. Yet to judge from that picture, all the rest must have been well worth seeing. The picture showed the box reserved in the theater for the President of the United States. At first glance, one might have thought it was not a stage box, but the stage itself. So far flung was the sweep of its breastwork. This breastwork was made entirely of gold, to the smallest detail. Between its slender columns, as delicately carved as if cut out by a fine pair of scissors, medallions of former presidents were arrayed side by side. One of these had a remarkably straight nose, curling lips, and a downward-looking eye hooded beneath a full, rounded eyelid. Rays of light fell into the box from all sides and from the roof. The foreground was literally bathed in light, white but soft, while the recess of the background, behind red damask curtains, falling in changing folds from roof to floor and looped with cords, appeared like a duskily glowing empty cavern. One could scarcely imagine human figures in that box, so royal did it look. Carl was not quite rapt away from his dinner, but he laid the photograph beside his plate and sat gazing at it. He would have been glad to look at even one of the other photographs, but he did not want to rise and pick one up himself, since an attendant had his hand resting on the pile, and the sequence probably had to be kept unbroken,
so he only craned his neck to survey the table, trying to make out if another photograph were being passed along. To his great amazement, it first seemed incredible, he recognized among those most intent upon their plates a face which he knew well.
"Giacomo!" he cried.
Shy as ever when taken by surprise, Giacomo got up from his seat, turned round in the narrow space between the benches, wiped his mouth with his hand, and then showed great delight at seeing Carl, suggesting that Carl should come and sit beside him, or he should change his own place instead. They had a lot to tell each other, and should stick together all the time. Carl, not wanting to disturb the others, said perhaps they had better keep their own places for the time being. The meal would soon be finished, and then, of course, they would stick together. But Carl still lingered a moment or two, only for the sake of looking at Giacomo. What memories of the past were recalled? What happened to the man address? What was Therese doing? Giacomo himself had hardly changed at all in appearance. The manageress's prophecy that in 6 months' time he would develop into a large-boned American had not been fulfilled. He was as delicate-looking as before, his cheeks hollow as ever, though at the moment they were bulging with an extra-large mouthful of meat from which he was slowly extracting the bones to lay them on his plate. As Carl could see from his armband, he was not engaged as an actor either, but as a lift boy. The theater of Oklahoma really did seem to have a place for everyone. But Carl's absorption in Giacomo had kept him too long away from his own seat. Just as he was thinking of getting back, the staff manager arrived, climbed onto one of the upper benches, clapped his hands, and made a short speech while most of the people rose to their feet, those who remained in their seats, unwilling to leave their dinners, being nudged by the others until they too were forced to rise. "I hope," said the staff manager, Carl meanwhile having tiptoed back to his place, "that you have been satisfied with our reception of you and the dinner we have given you. The recruiting squad is generally supposed to keep a good kitchen. I'm sorry we must clear the table already, but the train for Oklahoma is going to leave in 5 minutes. It's a long journey, I know, but you'll find yourself well looked after. Let me now introduce the gentleman in charge of your transport arrangements, whose instructions you will please follow." A lean little man scrambled up on the bench beside the staff manager, and scarcely taking time to make a hasty bow, began waving his arms nervously to direct them how to assemble themselves in an orderly manner and proceed to the station. But he was at first ignored, for the man who had made a speech at the beginning of the dinner now struck the table with his hand and began to return thanks in a lengthy oration. Carl was growing quite uneasy about it. He had just been told that the train was leaving in 5 minutes. He was not even deterred by the patent inattention of the staff manager, who was giving various instructions to the transport official. He built up his oration in the grand manner, mentioning each dish that had been served and passing a judgment on each individually, winding up with a declaration, "Gentlemen, that is the way to our hearts." Everyone laughed except the gentleman he was addressing, but there was more truth than jest in his statement, all the same. This oration brought its own penalty, since the road to the station had now to be taken at a run. Still, that was no great hardship, for, as Carl only now remarked, no one carried any luggage. The only thing that could be called luggage was the perambulator, which the father was pushing at the head of the troop, and which jolted up and down wildly if no hand were steadying it. What destitute, disreputable characters were here assembled, and yet how well they had been received and cared for, and the transport official must have been told to cherish them like the apple of his eye. Now he was taking a turn at pushing the perambulator, waving one hand to encourage the troop. Now he was urging on stragglers in the rear. Now he was careering along the ranks, keeping an eye on the slower runners in the middle, and trying to show them with swinging arms how to run more easily. When they reached the station, the train was ready for departure. People in the station pointed out the newcomers to each other, and one heard exclamations such as, "All these belong to the Theater of Oklahoma!" The theater seemed to be much better known than Carl had assumed. Of course, he had never taken much interest in theatrical affairs. A whole carriage was specifically reserved for their troupe. The transport official worked harder than the guard at getting people onto it. Only when he had inspected each compartment and made a few arrangements did he get into his own seat. Carl had happened to get a window seat, with Giacomo beside him. So they sat, the two of them, close together, rejoicing in their hearts over the journey. Such a carefree journey in America they had never known. When the train began to move out of the station, they waved from the window, to the amusement of the young men opposite, who nudged each other and laughed. For 2 days and nights they journeyed on. Only now did Carl understand how huge America was. Unweariedly, he gazed out the window, and Giacomo persisted in struggling for a place beside him until the other occupants of the compartment, who wanted to play cards, got tired of him and voluntarily surrendered the other window seat. Carl thanked them. Giacomo's English was not easy for anyone to follow, and in the course of time, as is inevitable among fellow travelers, they grew much more friendly, although their friendliness was sometimes a nuisance, as for example, whenever they ducked down to rescue a card fallen on the floor, they could not resist giving hearty tweaks to Carl's legs or Giacomo's. Whenever that happened, Giacomo always shrieked in renewed surprise and drew his legs up. Carl attempted once to give a kick in return, but suffered the rest of the time in silence. Everything that went on in the little compartment, which was thick with cigarette smoke in spite of the open window, faded in comparative insignificance before the grandeur of the scene outside. The first day they traveled through a high range of mountains. Masses of blue-black rock rose in sheer wedges to the railway line. Even craning one's neck out of the window, one could not see their summits. Narrow, gloomy, jagged valleys opened out, and one tried to follow with a pointing finger the direction in which they lost themselves. Broad mountain streams appeared, rolling in great waves down onto the foothills and drawing with them a thousand foaming wavelets, plunging underneath the bridges over which the train rushed, and they were so near that the breath of coldness rising from them chilled the skin of one's face.